It seems fitting somehow that we're recording this conversation with Steven Pinker on Monday when, on page one of the New York Times, there's a description of a lawsuit over the word how and whether how can be trademarked for the exclusive use of one person or another or one party or another. That's just an example of the kinds of linguistic battlegrounds that exist in the world and have been chronicled in many Steven Pinker books. But right now we are talking about The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. Steven Pinker researches language and cognition as Johnstone Family Professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. Just as importantly, he is the chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. So he may even be called as a witness in the Howe case. Who knows? In one of those two capacities. First of all, welcome to the show. We're very excited to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
So I've been thinking about things that come up in the book and the way in which they sort of haunt us in our lives. And I'm going to give you an example. I worked for 20 years as a reporter at a newspaper, and there was somebody who worked at the newspaper, clearly not somebody who worked in reporting or most of all copy editing, had ordered these memo pads, and they must have ordered millions of them, because in the 20 years that I was there, there was no escaping them. No matter how many of them you used up, more of them would just appear in its place. And it said at the top of the memo pad, it said, verbal orders, and then it said in quotation marks, don't go, close quotation marks. And then it said, write it down, exclamation point. And all of us who were reporters and copy editors who were sort of dimly aware of the fact, or even keenly aware of the fact, that a verbal order and a written order are essentially the same thing.
Yes.
And well, go ahead, yeah.
People use verbal as a synonym for oral.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's this is exactly the kind of issue that the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary would be concerned with. Namely, if enough people use verbal to mean oral, then game over. That's what verbal means, because there's no one who actually legislates on the question of the correct meaning of words. You want to be understood, and if 99% of people interpret a word one way, it's kind of futile to say, sorry, you guys are wrong, but we 1% get to use the word the way we want. In the case of verbal for oral, you know, there's that old saying attributed to the movie mogul Sam Goldwyn, a verbal contract isn't worth the paper it's written on.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't be funny unless people interpreted verbal as meaning oral. And if you say an oral contract isn't worth the paper it's written on, that's a bit more precise. But the fact that people will smile when they hear the other one shows that you and I and your colleagues may have lost on that one.
So that's the prescriptive versus descriptive dichotomy that you and others make, that ultimately we're descriptive about language. We have to acknowledge the way that language is used as opposed to the way we would prescribe it to be used and the things we would prescribe against.
That's right. I don't think it's a dichotomy. It's there are clearly some forms that are wrong by the expectations of a literate readership. When you send around a lolcat with the caption, I can has cheeseburger, that wouldn't be funny unless we all realize that, yes, there are some things that are just wrong. On the other hand, a lot of things that people say are wrong, there's just no basis for saying that they're wrong. There are a lot of bogus rules that are out there. And indeed, the final arbiter has to be the people who use the language, just because it's not like the rules of Major League Baseball. There's no one in charge.
Well, just back to that infernal memo pad, it had another thing in it, which you, in fact, do chronicle in your book. It said verbal orders, quotation marks, don't go, close quotation marks. I could never quite figure out why those quotation marks were there and whether don't go was some kind of military idiom that I didn't know or something like that. But this is, you won my heart even more dearly by using a Zippy the Pinhead cartoon strip to illustrate this. This is another kind of pollution in our lives, right? The public enclosure of various phrases and quotation marks for reasons that are intuitive to the person enclosing them, but not obvious to the rest of us.
Yes, like, you know, the sign in the gas station that says, we have, quote, ice, unquote. Like, do you have ice or do you have something that's only rumored to be or alleged to be ice? And it's even more disconcerting when you see a sign that says things like, you know, fresh, in quotes, seafood, right, or employees must, quote, wash hands, unquote. And you wonder, are they really washing hands or are they just doing something that is alleged to be washing hands? Well, what the sign makers are doing actually is not that mysterious. They're using the quotes for emphasis. And in the same way that if you compose an email in plain text and you don't have italics available to you, or in the prehistoric days of computer text processing, when the printers and terminals didn't even have italics, we'd put an asterisk on either side of a word to let it scream out. And some of us still do. Sometimes you put an underscore character on either side. So the sign makers are using quotation marks for the same purpose, not sufficiently aware that quotation marks have a completely different purpose and that they are sometimes being unintentionally comical.
Maybe they're quoting God. You know, who says the seafood is fresh? God, that's who says it, in quotes. The Holy Ghost, something like that. We're talking to Steven Pinker right now. Well, you know, just go back to prescriptive versus descriptive. It seems to me there are certain areas where there's a kind of cognitive laziness that creeps in that might, in fact, be worth fighting back against. I actually have a college friend from many, many years ago who works in Baltimore and is slowly being driven insane by the use of the preposition around to mean pertaining to or about. So we're having some discussions around this question. And he, I mean, every day he issues, or periodically, he issues these long emails of around being used in this context of the various meetings that he goes to at some big financial firm or the kinds of place where people have meetings and use language rather imprecisely. And I don't blame him for this, because it seems to me that what's happened is that around has started to be a little bit catchy, started to have a kind of status to it that if you're using it this way. But it also, it seems to me like bailing out on what it is you're really trying to say.
Well, this is an example of what people in the language business call peevology. Namely, everyone has
yes,
some peeve about the way other people use words, many of which really have no particular grounding in logic or precision or accuracy, or even usage, because once an expression becomes commonly enough used, then a generation grows up and just doesn't hear anything wrong with it. Past generations were driven crazy by the use of the word contact as a verb, as in I'm going to contact him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now it's very hard to imagine what the fuss was about, but in the day this was considered, you know, newfangled business jargon, or to finalize something, or to prioritize, or a man who is balding, or a couple who are divorcing. All of those were peeves in their day, long forgotten, and we just get over it. My own feeling is that for one thing, I would have to go to the books to see if discussion around actually has been increasing, because often what happens is you notice something
mm-hmm.
more, and so you assume that it's actually been increasing in usage, whereas it may just be you noticing it more. It's often surprising how many peeves that people believe are new innovations have been in the language for decades, if not centuries.
Although, you know, that actually brings up, I want to come back to around in just a second, but it does bring up one of my favorite recent words that I've been introduced to, which, and I think it may be a recent coinage, prochronism, which is the, if you're watching Masters of Sex, which is set in the 1950s and early 1960s, and somebody talks about a steep learning curve, and I'm sitting there thinking, there's no way that was in currency then. But as you say, sometimes we think that something's a prochronism, when in fact it's been used longer than we think it has.
Yeah, indeed, and that's a very common discovery, including many points of disputed usage, like the use of disinterested to mean bored as opposed to impartial,
mm-hmm.
or the use of enormity to mean large size as opposed to great evil. Those go back hundreds of years, although people will insist that it is an increasing error.
Well, I want to go back to around for a second, and this may not be the best example of it, but we know that Orwell talks about, you know, the fact that when people misuse language, when they use it imprecisely, when they use words that seem to be preposterous, sometimes they're covering up something, you know, and some something that sometimes they're covering up, as Orwell would say, abominations.
Sometimes, yes.
Sometimes.
Certainly when there are euphemisms like collateral damage or ethnic cleansing, they may be covering up crimes that one doesn't want to speak about in concrete terms, lest people know exactly what's happening. But it is, it would be going overboard to say that every peeve is an example of covering up a crime. I think Orwell did point out to an important thing to look out for in government propaganda, but not every sin of writing is a crime against humanity.
But, you know, I wonder about this. I wonder whether Richard Nixon would prefer to have had some conversations around domestic surveillance as opposed to having some conversations pertaining to domestic surveillance. Around seems just a little bit fuzzier, you know? It seems like a little bit less ascribable to you. I'm not going to win this battle with you.
I'm not sure if I'm getting that intuition myself.
But I think
it seems to me that, you know, prepositions often figure into idioms in ways that are completely arbitrary, and that someone who acquiring English as a second language in adulthood often finds baffling. I won't put up with that, but I won't tolerate that. You don't say I don't tolerate with that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of dictionaries just say this is the preposition you use if you want to be idiomatic. So my own feeling is that the about and around are pretty synonymous, and I doubt that there's any kind of attempt to shade meaning there. It may just be that the idioms change over time. By the way, you are correct that discussion around has been increasing probably since 1920. I just opened up a window to go to the actual data, the Google Ngram viewer, and it has been increasing, but not that recently. The increase started in 1920.
Wow. We're talking to Stephen Bigger, his book, The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. So to a certain degree, you do mean this book to be something of a style book in the sense of Strunk and White, maybe in the sense of William Zinsser. I don't know if you also mean it in the sense of, I mean, most of us in journalism operate to greater or lesser degrees under style books. I mean, the New York Times has its own style book. NPR, I think, has a style book. I mean, journalistic entities have a style book. They make decisions like whether President of the United States, whether that P is capitalized, if we're just talking about the president without actually saying President Obama, things like that. Do you mean, what status do you want this book to have for people?
Yes, it's clearly not a style book in the sense of regulating a house style for a particular context. So it's closer to the classic books like by Zinsser and Strunk and White and others. That is, if you're, very few people write for a single outlet like the New York Times or the American Psychological Association journals. So this is more for a generic literate audience. You're writing for, not just for composing an email where there's a lot of forgiveness in terms of spelling, punctuation, grammar, and so on. But if you're writing something that's meant to be looked at, perused, enjoyed, a review, a blog post, an article, a term paper, a memo, how to make those clear and enjoyable to read.
Well, it does seem to me as though many of the conversations one does have about words and their usage and their meaning are at least potentially political, in Orwell's sense anyway. I mean, here at NPR, we had, I don't really work for National Public Radio, but National Public Radio had this crisis of conscience a few years ago because stylistically it had determined not to call waterboarding torture, that they felt that the word torture was too value-laden, was too much of an assessment of something like waterboarding. It's not for us to say that it's torture. And this infuriated a lot of language mavens. People like Bob Garfield, who also kind of works within public radio, went nuts saying, well, no, that in fact deprives the word torture of its implicit meaning. I mean, these conversations we have about words and style, sometimes they're aesthetic, but sometimes they're of dire importance, right?
Absolutely, because they determine what kind of moral valuation you put on the action. We have categories like murder, like torture, like genocide, like rape. And so whether you apply it to a particular act determines how you treat that act, whether you punish it, whether you give it a pass, how severely you punish it, and so on.
I wondered if you'd given much thought to, particularly as a cognitive scientist, I think this gets kind of interesting too, one of the I'm old enough to have operated as a writer in a bunch of different contexts. So one of the different contexts in which I operate now is sometimes when I'm writing, my computer will underline a word. Unbidden, the little red line will squiggle out under a word. And I'll look at that little red line and I'll think, well, that means that Microsoft or Bill Gates or somebody doesn't like this word. Somebody doesn't even feel that it's right. Either they don't agree that it exists or they don't think I'm using it correctly.
Yes, right.
And it's a very strange little battle that goes on for me as a writer. I'm thinking I'm absolutely comfortable. I mean, this happened to me. I can give you a specific example if you want from the last 36 hours. But you know, I'm sort of thinking, wow, I'm now having this kind of silent mental conversation with, in a sense, a machine or a piece of software about how language gets used.
Indeed, yes. Usually the red wiggly line simply indicates a word that isn't in its dictionary, and so it's a potential misspelling or typo. The green wiggly line attempts to flag errors of grammar, and in the first few iterations of Word, the green wiggly line was utterly infuriating because it used guidelines like minimize the number of times use the passive voice, and it was kind of like the grammar school teacher of your nightmares. But I've noticed in recent iterations, it's gotten much more selective and much more accurate. And very often, if you see that green wiggly line, it means you've made an error in number agreement. So if you write something like, the impact of the cuts have not been felt yet, that sounds like a perfectly normal sentence until you think, oh, wait a second, what? It's the impact has not been felt yet, not have not been felt yet. The writer of a sentence like that was misled by the fact that the word cuts, which is plural, is sitting next to have, and so he made the verb agree with the noun next to it instead of the subject of the sentence, which really is a grammatical error. And it's the kind of thing that the green wiggly line is actually pretty good at detecting. I only realized this when I wrote a section in the sense of style on the kind of grammatical errors that can slip into your prose without realizing it. And as I typed in the errors in my manuscript, I got the green wiggly line. I thought, oh, yes, not bad.
Yeah, well, exactly.
It doesn't catch all of them, and some of the things it catches aren't worth paying attention to, but it's surprising how good it has gotten.
No, I think of the green wiggly line as my friend, and I look at it, and I think that maybe it is seeing something, an agreement issue that I'm not spotting right away. And you're right. It's gotten more nuanced as time has gone along. Now, the red line, and I'll give you my example, so because it also has all kinds of interesting reciprocal implications. So I use the term Procrustean, and which is, of course, a wonderful word, and it has its roots in Greek mythology to this horrible giant who was an innkeeper, and he would put people on a bed, and then they would be too short, so he would stretch them, and then they would be too long, and he would chop their legs off. And so it's a great term. The only question is whether you capitalized the P or not when you used it. But I got a little red line, and I thought, well, I have no hesitation using this term. On the other hand, what if it pops up on my editor's screen with a little red line? Because that's a phone call right there. Like, what's this word? The computer doesn't recognize it. And then it becomes kind of important. Like, who gets to decide? Who's making this little red line? At least with the American Heritage Dictionary, I can call up Pinker and say, what do you mean you don't have that? But I don't even know where, you know, who's the council of hooded figures that decides what gets a little red wiggly line?
Yes, yes, you've got to stand up to the red wiggly line at times, absolutely.
I wanted to talk a little bit about academic language. So we've all had various experiences with this, and one of the things you talk about in the book is what you call the kind of the classic style, you know, which is, as I understand it anyway, direct and conversational, and meant to forge a bond with the reader so that the reader understands. I mean, it's done with the reader in mind. You know, Kurt Vonnegut used to talk about his sister. He had a sister who loved him but didn't idolize him. So when he wrote, he imagined his sister looking over his shoulder, and if he didn't think that she would buy it or get it or understand it, then he thought he'd gone too far. This is kind of, I think, what you're talking about, right?
Indeed. Together with the image that you are showing the reader something in the world. So yes, the reader is your equal. You're having a conversation with the reader. But what you're trying to get across to the reader is something that has nothing to do with you. It has something to do with the world. And that's the other thing that differentiates classic prose from a lot of academies and bureaucraties and other kinds of professionalese.
So, I mean, but I think we've all had the experience, or many of us have anyway, of handing in something. In my early days as an undergraduate at a university nearby here, here, whose name begins with Y, I remember handing in things that I had written in a pretty classic style. I mean, a much more conversational, not ornately embellished with academies, and having a teaching assistant regarded as the work of somebody who clearly had nothing profound to say, because if I wasn't using words like ontological, I must not have anything of any consequence to say, and fighting that battle, and then sort of giving in and thinking, all right, you know,
I'll ladle out all the verbiage.
Right. This is how I get the food pellet. I'll be the rat. I'll press the lever, and I'll use these words, but I don't feel good about it.
You know, I think that sometimes happens, but more often than not, bad academies and professionals comes all too naturally to people. I'm shocked at how students coming in the door in the graduate program at Harvard, without needing any kind of training or guidance or feedback, they just write in this turgid, bloated, stuffy, pompous academies, and they have to be trained out of it. So I agree, there are some people who have a natural gift, and if they're unlucky, they will have some benighted advisor or teaching assistant who says, no, add more gibberish, make it more stuffy. More often, I think it's the other way around. And surveys of even professional articles in academic journals show that it's not true that you cannot write in plain or stylish language. And some of the, certainly in my field in psychology, some of the greatest figures in the field were brilliantly clear and witty and humorous writers. So you can get away with it. And often the problem is that people all too easily write in pompous jargon.
What shocks me and worries me is that this is especially prevalent among the people who teach teachers, the kinds of people who teach people who are going to be future middle school teachers, high school teachers, elementary school teachers, in that world of education. And I got interested in this for other reasons recently, and I discovered this this teacher of teachers. Her name is Deborah Ball. She teaches at Michigan. She has revolutionized the teaching of math, and she's now regarded as one of the real gurus on how to teach. Well, she's got this website. I went there, and I started reading about what she calls high leverage practices, which I think means things that work. And then she says, one of them is making content explicit through explanation, modeling, representations, and examples. Making content explicit is essential to providing all students with access to fundamental ideas and practices in a given subject. Effective efforts to do this attend both to the integrity of the subject and to students' likely interpretations of it. I mean, it just went on and on like this, and I eventually, you know, translated it sort of back into English for my own sake. But I was thinking, this is a really smart woman, and in fact, she has done marvelous things about the teaching of math. But this is how teachers communicate with each other, and they think it's okay. They think this is, once again, kind of how you impress one another, that you can speak this strange fusion of bureaucraties and some kind of intellectual discourse.
Absolutely, and you're right that, ironically, it's often education professors and theoreticians and English professors who are the worst offenders. I think part of it may be an attempt to impress by using, you know, highfalutin gobbledygook that gives an aura of pseudoscientific sophistication. But a lot of it comes from the fact that experts naturally gravitate in this direction because they lose contact with the actual happenings on the ground. An education professor may not be spending all their time in the classroom, but rather studying reports of teachers in the classroom. And so you think in abstractions in terms of best practices and strategies and perspectives and contexts and levels. That's the way you, as an analyst, deal with the problem. And you forget that when it's time to communicate the results of this analysis, you need to go back to what's actually happening, to things that people can see with their own eyes and hear with their own ears. And instead, you use the same abstract categories. You write in the same abstract categories you've been using to analyze and think about them. And that's why it's often the expert, the more you know about something, the more tempting it is to write about it abstractly. You've got to train yourself, if you're an expert, to go back to the actual things that are happening. So if you're an expert on wildlife management, you might talk about excess wildlife mitigation strategies. And what it really means is, you know, trapping mice. But the traps are a distant memory. That's for the underlings to set out and empty. You're thinking about the strategies, what you're being paid to think about, and you forget about the concrete details. And classic style is very much about writing about things that you can see or hear, as opposed to the mental tools and categories and strategies and frameworks that you use to analyze something.
And I think that psychology, the psychology of I went to the trouble to learn this, you know, and to learn this language and to kind of master the way things are talked about in my field. I went to all this trouble. Now I have to use it. And I think that spills over into the psychology of prescriptive versus descriptive, too. I mean, if you went to the trouble as a human being to know what beg the question used to mean, then you're all the more irritated by the way it's used today. If you went to all the trouble of really getting a sense of what comprise in its strictest sense means and how it's different from constitutes and that kind of thing, the more furious you are about the fact that those distinctions have suddenly evaporated, right? It's the effort that we put in that creates these kinds of dissonances when we see that our effort is less and less meaningful.
Yes, and I think that does explain a lot of the irritation behind the peevers and the pedants and the snoots and the sticklers. It's I had to pay attention to learn these distinctions. Why can't you? But I think misuse or inattention to the fine details of word meaning is a different problem than the bloated professionalese and academies.
Mm-hmm.
Often the academies comes from being too much of an expert in something, and the words mean something to you, and you forget that they don't mean anything to anyone else. And there's a danger in thinking that people are using it for some selfish, nefarious purpose of showing off or flaunting expertise, because then it's too easy to get yourself off the hook and to realize that all of us are tempted to do it, not because we are trying to impress, but just because we have become so immersed in this little clubhouse where everyone uses the same language and where we think about something in these abstract terms, that we forget that there's a huge world outside of people who still need to be shown what's actually going on in the world. And so it's too easy to point your fingers at those bureaucrats or pseudoscientific academics and get yourself off the hook. It's a challenge for all of us to go back to the sensual, visual, tactile, auditory events in the world and to make sure that our prose is about that rather than the abstract categories and contexts and levels and frameworks and strategies that we legitimately think about those problems in, but that we illegitimately use to communicate them.
You know, I would just like to make a brief, I know you have to go, but I would like to make a brief case for nefariousness, at least in some instances. And I do feel as though, you know, it's no accident, and I think it's referenced in your book, that, you know, when they try to figure out who uses the most horrifically abstruse academic prose, for a long time it was the deconstructionists. It was Derrida and Paul de Man, who it turns out had other reasons for concealing what he was up to. But, you know, and reading their work, you would think, well, it's quite possible that what they're really concealing here is that this isn't that interesting an argument, and to the extent that it's interesting at all, it could be summarized in 25 words, not 25 books.
Yes. No, I don't disagree that undoubtedly happens. I guess the reason that I want to go beyond that is that in addition to the pompous blowhards who really have nothing to say and just dress it up in highfalutin verbiage, I also know sincere, brilliant scientists and scholars who have nothing to hide and no need to impress, and still their writing stinks. So I don't disagree with you, but I think the problem goes beyond that, that even with people who do have something to say, they often have the dickens of a time stating it clearly and simply.
All right. Well, I know you have to go, so I'm going to give you a present as we go. Bill Zinsser, occasionally when he would do a presentation about this, would produce a corporate memo which asked for a list of all employees broken down by sex.
Very good.
You can use that.
I'll try to steal that.
Yeah, steal that. Do something with it. Steven Pinker, so great to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. The book is The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. We'll be back after this.